This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
Purdue University Northwest School of Engineering is expanding, and it's also deepening its connections with industry and with manufacturing partners here in Northwest Indiana in some rather new and novel ways. And one of them is involving faculty internships. And with us to talk about it, we have the director of the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest, Professor Dietmar Remfer, with us. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure.
Well, tell us a little about this idea of a faculty internship. Is this a well-worn idea out in business and industry, or is this something new, or maybe it's really new for academia?
No, this is really a new and innovative idea in academia, certainly. Doing some research on this a couple of weeks back, I found out that Boeing had a somewhat similar program that they called their Williver Fellowship. That ended about 2005 or so, but in academia, this is an old idea. And I'm happy to say we have received fairly enthusiastic support for this idea, both in colleagues from academia. Others are interested in that as well. And my external advisory board was really very supportive.
What was the process of being able to take this idea that's worked very well in business, you mentioned with Boeing, and be able to extend it into Purdue University Northwest?
This is a program that was developed at the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest. Ultimately, it went back to ideas that I had that I discussed with my external advisory board. I have a number of industry representatives in this external advisory board from local and regional industries. We have a lot of support from NIPSCO, NiSource. We have the steel industry. ArcelorMittal is involved there. And so together with those representatives, I brought up this idea at one of the external advisory board meetings, and we developed it from there.
Mm-hmm. Will you be able to create a faculty internship? Give us an idea which faculty members are most likely to be interested in becoming interns in this way, and also to what they will certainly be involved in if they pick a business or an industry out there, as I know that you're starting to have now with your very first intern out there.
So this is a program for all faculty in the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest. And maybe going a little bit back to the background that this is built upon. Mm-hmm. One of the core ideas behind what we're doing with the School of Engineering, and going even further back, the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest is a very new school. It was founded in the summer of 2017. I was hired as the founding director of the School of Engineering. We had two engineering departments before. We have a Department of Mechanical and Civil Engineering and a Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. But then university leadership decided that we wanted to raise the profile of engineering at Purdue Northwest as a Purdue institution. Clearly, engineering should be one of the signature programs at the university. And so then the question is, how do we go about doing this? How do we raise the profile of engineering at Purdue Northwest and, frankly, in Northwest Indiana? And one of the things that are important to me personally as well is that a university and a school of engineering, they need to be embedded in the fabric of the region that is hosting them. So we want to build two-way relationships between the university, in my case, and of course, with the School of Engineering and the surrounding community of industry, innovators, communities, startup entrepreneurs, and all of these people. So the question is, how do we create these deeper connections? And so this faculty internship is one way to do this. Mm-hmm. The idea is that, on the one hand, we allow our stakeholders, entrepreneurs, people in industry, communities, to take advantage of the expertise that our faculty have. So if they have projects that they would like to have some help on, then we can make faculty expertise available to them. So this way we can help our surrounding community with the expertise that our faculty have. And on the other hand, our faculty have the opportunity to learn about new approaches, to learn about the current problems that industry is dealing with, and then to bring this knowledge back to the classroom so that they can train our students better, so that they stay up to date, and ultimately our students will be able to hit the ground running when they go back to industry.
Do you think that this is an opportunity that I know Purdue University, all of the campuses are very strong on, is experiential learning,
yeah.
Be able to get the student really ready for life outside of the Ivy walls, so to speak, and being ready to go out there in that profession that they would like to take on with their degree?
Yes, exactly. So experiential learning in all engineering schools across the nation, that is something that has become very important. If we go back in history a little bit, if you look at the way engineering schools were run in the 1950s, it turned out that actually the majority of faculty were people coming out of industry. They were practitioners. So the education of engineering graduates was very practically oriented. But then people realized that in order to have graduates that are ready for unknown challenges, for new technologies that are coming up, remember we were starting to think about going to the moon, there was this idea that our engineering graduates should be stronger on fundamentals. And this was the start of what was called the beginning of engineering science and the engineering scientist. And as a consequence, engineering departments became much more focused on hiring faculty that were scientists, that did research, and the education of engineers, certainly in four-year programs and beyond, became much more theoretical, which had all sorts of benefits. This was a good thing. So, as you know, we went to the moon and we developed all these new technologies. But there was a downside as well, in that the education became less practical, and industry started to notice that they needed to spend a significant amount of effort to take these graduates coming from engineering schools and make them ready to work and be productive for their enterprises. And so obviously time scales are relatively long. Things move slowly in academia sometimes. What happened then was there was more and more an emphasis on practical education. There is a central accrediting agency for engineering education, ABET, which then required all students to have what we call a capstone design experience. So this meant that practice-based learning and experiential learning became more important in engineering education. So fast forward to where we are now, all engineering schools that are accredited by ABET, meaning all engineering schools basically, have practice-based learning as part of their curriculum. So with this faculty internship, we're expanding the range of these things to not only have practice-based learning for our students, if you will, but also have practice-based learning and keep our faculty up to date with practice in industry.
Professor Renfrew, if there are any faculty members with the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest that are interested in getting involved in this internship program, how do they go about getting signed up to at least apply for it?
Yeah, so there is a process that faculty need to follow. They write a little proposal that describes the goals of this faculty internship. They are required to have some industry contacts, so they need to propose a specific partner or host, if you will, in industry, or could be a community partner. We had cases where people wanted to work with research labs. One of our faculty was interested in working with the University of Chicago Hospitals for a project. So faculty write this proposal, and we evaluate the proposals and then award a certain number of these fellowships, of these scholarships to all faculty.
I understand one of the professors, Tom Liu, is involved in this program. Now tell us about Professor Liu and what his internship is all about this time around.
Yeah, Dr. Liu was the first of our faculty to take advantage of this opportunity. He is someone working in fluid dynamics. He has actually done some fascinating work on fluid dynamics of flying insects and you know, biological problems in fluid mechanics. But he's also an expert in general of in experimental fluid mechanics, doing laser-based flow diagnostics, what we call particle image velocimetry methods, which allows you to do experiments where you can measure the full three-dimensional velocity field. So you get very detailed information of the flow field for flows around all sorts of devices. In this particular case, he had methods that allowed to measure flows in ducts and pipes, and that was his connection to Dwyer Industries, which is a regional company. They're headquartered here in Michigan City. And he was working with them to improve flow measurement systems that they use, and ultimately they benefit all sorts of flow systems in pipes with liquids, HVAC systems, so heating and air conditioning systems. Ultimately, this helps make these kinds of devices more energy efficient.
How does he think of the internship program he's in so far? Is he going to feel like he's going to be able to take something out of it and bring back to campus?
Yeah, so both partners in this particular collaboration are very happy with the result. Dr. Liu is bringing things back to the classroom. Dwyer Industries is also happy. They got some concrete developments out of that, some improvements of their systems.
You think maybe that some place down the road that Dwyer Industries may have an opportunity for an actual student intern, someone who's going through the process of learning and will pick up some actual experiential learning, as we've talked about?
Dwyer Industry actually does host student interns from the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest already, and we're continuing this program. We're actually, for many of the companies that we work with, I'm happy to say that we are ramping up our activities and our connections. There's all sorts of touch points between the School of Engineering and Industry beyond these faculty internships, which are brand new. Historically, we always had interns. Our students were working in local industry on projects. Our capstone design experience for our engineering students is also somewhat special, in that this is a two-semester program. Mm-hmm. Many engineering schools have just one semester of senior design projects. Our senior design projects are two-semester projects, which means they can be more expansive, and they usually result in concrete outcomes. And oftentimes, there's advances that these students make that are directly of use in industry.
Professor Diemer-Redfer, it sounds like that this is a great opportunity for not only for faculty members at the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest, but also for the seniors who are beginning their degrees from Purdue Northwest to pick up some of this as well, too. And let's hope that the internship program grows as it does over the years. Thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you very much.
Professor Diemer-Redfer is the director of the School of Engineering at Purdue University Northwest at the Hammond and the Westville campuses.
On Regionally Speaking on this Monday, let's find out the latest from Northwest Indiana political and otherwise activist Ruth Needleman. She's in the studio with us here in Merrillville to talk about some of the issues and some of the topics coming up. And Ruth, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Always my pleasure.
Well,
and
yes.
I actually thought I would start with a little reflection on Thanksgiving.
All right, go right ahead.
Because come this holiday, I personally will be in the airports on Wednesday and Sunday, so feel sorry for me. But I wanted to think about the question, who actually are immigrants? Because immigrants usually go to a country hoping to become part of the country, the society, and take advantage as well as contribute. But the first Europeans who reached the shores of this hemisphere, they were not immigrants. They were not seeking to integrate into the nations and millions of people who were already living here. They actually sought to replace what was here. They called it discovery. The people who were already here experienced it as genocide. Now, think about the people at our borders today. They are immigrants and refugees. Yet, we cage them. We pull apart their families, we refuse decent food and housing, and we send them back to the very countries they just fled from. And the majority are coming from three countries, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Close to 95% of the people who are being housed, caged, detained are actually indigenous, native to this hemisphere. They were here before a single European ever arrived. And yet, people here in the U.S. call the U.S. a nation of immigrants, but that really denies the origins of the United States. And our treatment of indigenous peoples and nations in this hemisphere continues to be overwhelmingly cruel and inhumane. So, do the indigenous nations of this hemisphere have anything to be thankful for this Thanksgiving? Well, I would say yes and no. Certainly not for the arrival of the marauders, or whatever you want to call them, who took their land and killed them, but certainly for their persistence in centuries of struggle for indigenous rights and respect. That is my Thanksgiving thoughts, and I hope when you're eating your Thanksgiving dinner, you will think about who was here and who were the people who landed here and pushed the indigenous away. That's that.
All right.
Now we can move on to less controversial comments. Tonight, now it is a holiday, and holidays can be really tough on people. For some people, they love to get together with their families, but there are a lot of people who don't have families, and a lot of people whose families might be the bane of their existence. And so I want to remind you, if you're one of the people that feels down around the holidays, who needs comfort and support, tonight at 6 o'clock, Can We Talk is having one of its gatherings. And we meet at Community Health Net right on 5th Avenue, lots of parking, and we serve a free meal at 6 o'clock, a good hot meal, and then we share music, poetry, comments, feelings, beliefs, and it is an amazingly supportive place. So if you think you need that extra little boost to get ready for the holidays, join us tonight at 6 o'clock for Can We Talk. Then, Tuesday, December 3rd, because now I'm jumping ahead because nobody's going to be listening to anything when they're eating their Thanksgiving dinners. At the Berglund Auditorium at IUN at 5 o'clock, there's going to be a selective viewing of the movie based on the Central Park Five, the five young African-American children who were accused of murdering a jogger and also whom the current presidents called for their death immediately, who were completely innocent. And it shows how the criminal system was incredibly unjust and discriminatory and how these lives were destroyed. And we'll have some people there on a panel. It's really worthwhile to join in this conversation because if you haven't seen any of this film, you need to. Then, following day, December 4th, Black Lives Matter will be meeting at Trinity United Church of Christ at 7 p.m., and that's at 1276 West 20th. Join their conversation. They are working right now on a town hall meeting on education. And boy, does Gary need to talk about what is happening to education in our city. Okay, an update on community benefits agreements. So, you know, a lot of development is going on all around the country, and a lot of people argue that development has to be done the way we're doing, attracting money into our cities and having new people brought into our cities. But really, a lot of the modern-day development involves displacement, dislocation, and gentrification. And that is true, especially in the Miller section of Gary, but it's becoming more and more true throughout Gary as they seek to tear down homes instead of repairing homes and providing low-cost housing for the people who are here. So right before the Common Council, right this time, they are voting on a community benefits agreement. There's an ordinance that's been put forward and supported widely. Eddie Melton supports it. Reagan Hatcher supports it. And almost every member of the Common Council supports it. And what it requires is the following. If you're going to build something here, you got to hire locally. And if they're not ready to work, you have to invest in the training of people from Gary to work in Gary so that the money stays in Gary and doesn't go to the suburbs, to Chicago, and elsewhere. Plus, it requires that if you are investing to make profit, that you also contribute to the community. For example, you fix up a playground. You provide new park improvements, or you help out on health care or housing improvements. In other words, if you are coming in to get rich, something has to come back to Gary. Call your Common Council representatives and tell them this has to be passed.
Do you know which council meeting is going to come up?
The next one.
The next one coming up.
Well, they had it up on the last one, and virtually every city council member said this is so needed in Gary, except for the president, Ron Brewer, who I still consider to be a felon, and he should not be sitting president of my Common Council. But he said, well, we should wait to see what Jerome Prince wants. And that's ridiculous. The people of Gary have worked for 5 years for community benefits agreement. We are finally close to passing one with a lot of support, and we don't have to wait for anybody because it's what the people want. Then I have a couple more things. One I think is very important. Did you know that sex trafficking is major in Indiana? I never thought about it much, but Dr. Kalyani Gopal has been working with an organization called Safe Human Rights, and she is trying to build a home in Indiana for trafficked children. And even more than that, to provide safe space, counseling, and support from veterans who also need counseling and support. And there are, she said, right now, 4 beds in all of Indiana for trafficked youth and women. And there are 25,000 women and children who are trafficked through this Midwest corridor. And where does it take place? In schools, bus stops, truck stops, youth centers, beauty salons, massage parlors, in our communities and neighborhoods. Of course, a lot of them who want to traffic use online, where they find lonely children who just want a little excitement in their lives. But the statistic is that within 5 years, they will be dead. So for Thanksgiving, let me suggest that you contribute to building a safe place in Northwest Indiana by donating to this organization, which is doing fabulous work. And the way to do it is to go to www.safechr.org. I just gave them a generous donation. We have to protect our children. We're closing their schools. We're teaching them to test. And they are being they're not being cared for by our society. And the result is horrendous conditions for women and children. One other place you can donate for Thanksgiving is the Urban League of Northwest Indiana. Now, this organization really does a lot, providing minority scholarships, providing all kinds of support for especially youth in Gary. And you can call 219-887-9621 and free to everybody, a gospel explosion sponsored by the Urban League. It will be Friday, December 6th at St. John Baptist Church at 2457 Massachusetts, 7 to 9, free to all.
Well, Ruth, it sounds like it's a great weekend ahead for people to relax and reflect and even celebrate, too, as you mentioned, with the Urban League of Northwest Indiana. Thank you for spending time with us to bring us up to date on the calendar, and we hope to have you here. I know certainly in the next month ahead. Thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely, and you have a good holiday.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Ed Feigenbaum is a correspondent. He's the creator of the Indiana Political Insight and the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletters for Hannah News Service, and he is with us on Regionally Speaking today to bring us up to date on a number of things. Of course, we have the General Assembly, which is just about a month or so, I guess, away from starting another session. They had their recent organization day, and it was a very busy day, Ed, I understand, not only for the lawmakers, but for everybody that seemed to want to try and park in downtown Indianapolis, too, wasn't it?
Absolutely, Chris. Thank you for having me on to discuss Thanksgiving Day turkey recipes.
That's right. Well, we can bring that up, too, if you'd like to, too.
I
was thinking we have enough days here. And Organization Day, of course, is starting it out here, and then it's followed, of course, by Thanksgiving Day. So, yes, it just makes sense. It goes from one celebration to another, I guess. What observance or what ideas do you take? This usually is Organization Day is just procedural more than anything else, I know. A chance for probably for some lawmakers that haven't seen each other since this time at the end of the last session, there back in this case, back in March, I guess, or even April, to get together and talk about the issues. I know some lawmakers have had a chance through the summer months to get together on some study committees and look at some of the issues. How do you think that things seem to shape up now for the 2020 session?
Well, we also have three new lawmakers who have not necessarily met all of their colleagues yet and have not been able to participate in a session. You have Stacey Donato from Logansport, who replaced Senator Brandy Head. You have Darlene Sherman from the south side of Indianapolis and north side of Johnson County, who replaced veteran State Rep Dave Frizzell at the end of the session. And then the third one is Ann Vermillion from Marion, a healthcare administrator who replaced Kevin Mann, who is moving on up the ranks in the House before he decided to retire and move his family to Indianapolis for a new job opportunity that he couldn't turn down. But all of these people are coming together, and I don't think that there's a whole lot that's new on the agenda that we have not talked about before that we've not expected since the end of the 2019 session. You know, obviously, in terms of budget issues, even though we are not going to reopen the budget, as legislative leaders caution, we will be doing some of that with respect to the priorities that the governor has outlined with respect to spending some of the money that he's gotten for the state from a renegotiation of the toll road lease. And he wants to spend some of that at the state fairgrounds, wants to spend some of that on broadband projects around the state, has some other ideas for spending some of that, and that will be done. And then, of course, you know, there's the education issues that legislative leaders and the governor all agreed upon, Democrats and Republicans, in terms of holding teachers harmless for the test results from iLearn. And then, of course, there's going to be, you know, a little bit of discussion about how we're going to move forward on education issues and, in particular, education funding issues, and specifically teacher pay and administrators and the whole question of school consolidation, those kinds of things, school referenda, that will lead us into the 2021 session when the real heavy lift will take place mm-hmm. on those issues.
I know that there had been some discussion earlier, and we've had a chance to talk with State Senator Karen Talion of Northern Indiana about some of the issues I know that she thought about bringing up when the session does open up. And here again, you mentioned that the entire city budget's not going to be reopened, but I'm sure they're going to try and pry a few places open to do some more work, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And as much as leaders always protest and say, well, we're not going to reopen the budget in an off-year session, you know, literally every other bill that comes before them has some kind of fiscal impact and does that whether they like it or not. But I think this time will be a little bit more open in terms of how things operate with respect to, you know, the priorities that have been outlined by the governor, and you will see some of that happen. One of the other issues that I neglected to mention that came up on Organization Day as a result of some of the things that have happened in late October and earlier this month, will be restrictions, further restrictions on vaping and perhaps some kind of additional restrictions on age with respect to tobacco purchases.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like legislators are really going to crack down on vaping and teens in particular, and will extend the same kind of protections or restrictions, what have you, to teens with respect to tobacco as well.
I didn't have a chance to ask you earlier about the idea of how you mentioned some of the legislators that are coming into office with some new faces that were showing up on Organization Day and will be back in session in January. But what's your take about the latest elections, the municipal elections? Not as exciting, perhaps, as some of the state representative and state senate races that are always out there. But what's your take on what happened here back in November?
Right. And in general, they weren't particularly interesting, but it's you know, a lot like when a friend tells you that they're having, you know, surgery, you say, well, that's minor surgery. Well, maybe to you, but anytime you've got surgery performed on you, it's major surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So just like that with respect to the mayoral races, you know, we may not think that there was a particularly important race or hotly contested race in Auburn or Angola or New Albany. But to those people, it was a very important race, and the candidates expended a lot of time and effort, and they're to be commended for putting themselves before the voters. But in general, you know, we didn't see much change in terms of the top 10 cities, maybe even the top 15 cities around the state, except where mayors had decided already to step down and there were open seats. But even then, we didn't see a lot of turnover. I think the Republicans did a little bit better than people might have expected around the state. But again, when you look at the big cities around the state, you know, it really didn't seem to mean that there is much difference, or we didn't seem to find much difference between party division as we went in and as we came out. And the Democrats were really looking to this election to help build their bench. I think that they're going to be looking at the next set of legislative elections to do the same. Already a whole bunch of legislative candidates on both sides, but particularly on the Democratic side, have emerged for the 2020 elections. And some of that is a result of the two congressional seats that are open. The seat in central Indiana, the Susan Brooks seat in the 5th District, and then, of course, the Northwest Indiana seat that Representative Pete Bisclosky is going to vacate after more than 35 years. And both of those seats are seeing some legislators express some interest. And when that happens, you know, you create a cascade of dominoes, if I'm not mixing metaphors here.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you know, you've got all kinds of different people looking at different offices are becoming open. And when that happens for the first time at the top in 30-something years, as you've got with the first congressional district, you know, there is a lot of pent-up demand, just like the situation in the legislature when we didn't address the elephant on the table. Speaker Brian Bosma said that he's going to step down as speaker at the end of this coming session, after the longest run for a Speaker of the House in Indiana.
One of the other issues I know we often talk about when we have a chance to talk with you, that is bringing us up to date on gaming issues. We're kind of in a quiet spell now. I guess we've gotten past the recent change. The big change that got all the publicity lately was, of course, the final inaction and putting into implementation of mobile gaming here in Indiana. How does things seem to go for the first months of mobile gaming in the Hoosier State? And also, too, you always keep a close eye on how the situation in Illinois is, in Chicago in particular, with casinos opening up or possibly opening up over there. What's the latest?
Well, let me address the mobile gaming situation first and then
okay.
Kind of segue into other issues with respect to gaming in Indiana before maybe getting into Chicago. But the mobile gaming took off like wildfire, and what it really demonstrated in Indiana is that legislators, perhaps unintentionally, created a situation of haves and have-nots and kind of changed the balance between some of the different casinos. Because what they did was, in passing the sports wagering legislation in April, is that they unintentionally granted each casino, or I say intentionally granted each casino, three potential mobile gaming operators, three skins. But what they didn't realize, I think, was that the way that these casinos would go out and partner with these mobile operators would have a real impact on the balance of power within the casino industry in Indiana. So you've got two operators in particular that are very well established around the state with respect to their daily fantasy sports operations, DraftKings and FanDuel. And DraftKings has partnered with Ameristar East Chicago and with Hollywood Casino in Lawrenceburg, the casino closest to Cincinnati. And FanDuel has partnered with the Boyd Gaming Corporation boats, the Belterra Casino Resort down in southeastern Indiana, and of course, the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City. And because those two operators already had a tremendous following, a really big base of potential customers and the folks that have been used to dealing with them, when they went into operation, they took off like hotcakes. In particular, Ameristar, because DraftKings, you know, ended up going live on the first possible day in Indiana, and as a result, you know, they kind of overshadowed the Rush Street Interactive operation that's partnered with French Lick. Now, Rush Street Interactive, of course, is partnered with or part of Rivers Casino in Des Plaines, Illinois. So the two big mobile operators in the daily fantasy sports world got bigger basically in Indiana because of their ability to attract the people that were already with them. And then we also see in Illinois that they're kind of stuck in what they call the penalty box for 18 months. So they're not going to be able to operate for 18 months after the other operators start in Illinois. So they're going to be concentrating on Indiana in order to get those Illinois dollars coming across the line. Now, what it also means, you know, when I said that each operator gets three skins, is that the really small operators, for example, Rising Star Casino Resort in southeastern Indiana, the smallest casino in the state that brings in, you know, basically about 10% of what Horseshoe Casino Hammond does each month, maybe even a little bit less than that, has the same opportunity as Horseshoe to go out there and bring in money through their mobile wagering operator. And already, Rising Star has partnered with three different skins and brought in, I think it's about $6 or $7 million, maybe even a little bit more, just in licensing fees. That's essentially free cash for them. And the skins are going to be building out their sports book at their facility at no cost to them. That's actually already been done. They've got a retail facility open there. So they've got an opportunity to compete with the big boys, you know, with Horseshoe Hammond, with what's going to be Caesars Southern Indiana outside of Louisville on the same terms. And, you know, we've not seen the Caesars operations debut their mobile sports books yet. And they're going to be using kind of a proprietary system. So if we're going to see some of these other operators in the mobile end of things gain in the ability to attract new patrons, new revenue. It may even overshadow some of their other revenue. If you look at what Ameristar did in October with respect to the mobile wagering, the amount of money that they brought in on mobile sports wagering was more than they brought in at their table games functions.
Now, Ed, we've got about less than a minute left. Can you bring us up to date on the Illinois casino situation?
Wish I knew, wish anybody knew. I think Mayor Lightfoot wishes she understood what was going on. I think she thought that she brought a reasonable proposal down to Springfield for the veto session. Legislators disagreed. And, you know, as you and I talked a month ago or so, I think the last two times we talked, I said, you know, you've got so many other people who already got what they wanted that it's going to be very difficult to reopen this just for the benefit of Chicago, because it would not advantage the folks that have already gotten what they asked for.
Well, Ed, thank you very much for the update. We really appreciate it on all of the fronts here, on the political as well as the gaming front. And I know we'll have much more to talk about sometime during the month of December here. We'll get together. And, of course, as the General Assembly session comes up to starting up in January, we'll have a lot more after that, too. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you, Chris, and look forward to talking turkey with you again early next year.
Same here. Thank you very much. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator of Indiana Political Insight and Indiana Gaming Insight newsletters for Hanna News Service, and this is Regionally Speaking. It's almost Thanksgiving here in Northwest Indiana, and that also means, too, it's time for the 12th annual Lakeshore Classic. With us to talk about it, we have Chuck Hughes with the Gary Chamber of Commerce. Chamber is always a big supporter and a big organizer for the event. And Chuck, thank you for joining us today.
Chris, it's a pleasure being here. I am excited about sharing about the 12th annual Lakeshore Classic.
Tell us 12 years ago how it all got started.
Well, the way it started is, as you know, I'm a director of the Chamber of Commerce. We're a business organization. But I decided to two things. One, sort of utilize sports like they do in other cities, like Indianapolis and others. Attract people to the region. Let them know they can come into Gary, Indiana, in fact. And be able to have a wonderful time. And also, it's geared toward our youth, our student athletes, to give them the opportunity to host teams from around the state and some from out of state, Illinois, other places, and be able to be showcased, sort of to inspire them to aspire to be better students and better athletes.
Going back to the first couple, three years of the event here, organizations, sports teams got together, high school teams in particular, of course, got together to be in the Classic itself.
Well, here's what I really appreciated about the first. You know, our games are on the Friday and Saturday after Thanksgiving, but we have a corporate luncheon on that Tuesday every year. And I'm happy to say that we had some great region buy-in. Bryce Drew, in fact, was our first corporate luncheon speaker. You know the Drew family, legends in Valparaiso.
That's right.
So Bryce consented to be our first speaker, and that gave us a good impetus to go to where we are now, 12 years later.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you mentioned some of the teams.
That's right, yeah.
We've had a lot of region teams. Now, I will say this, it's been difficult getting a lot of our suburban schools to participate. And maybe in the 13th year, we'll encourage them to be more apart. But we've had teams like this year. We have teams from Chicago. We have two teams from Indianapolis. But we do have our local Gary High Schools and charter schools. And so it's a great event. And we've tried to really showcase and bring some outstanding talent here to Northwest Indiana. Bryce Drew, Bob Love, Greg Popovich, Oscar Robertson, Dick Barnett, Junior Bridgman, Lloyd McClendon, Jesse White. Last year, LaTroy Hawkins. This year, the great Kenny Lofton. So we've stepped up.
Now, the events are always held at the in Gary at the Westside Leadership Academy. What do they get to do to get prepared for such a big event like this?
Well, you know, Westside has been a sectional site in the past, and teams really buy to have their home facility as a sectional site. And so when we can bring people in, bring teams in, bring media in, bring officials in, and to demonstrate that a first-rate event can take place, it certainly deems well for them. Also, Westside's girls team and boys team are both participants in addition to being the host facility.
Let's take a look now at the 12th annual Lakeshore Classic. It's actually coming up starting first, as you mentioned, with the corporate luncheon. That's going to be on Tuesday the 26th, the Tuesday before the weekend games. And it's always a big event in its own right. Tell us who the special speaker is going to be on Tuesday.
That's going to be a 17-year major leaguer, East Chicago native, East Chicago, Washington basketball and baseball star, University of Arizona basketball star, and a guy who is on the precipice of entering the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame, Mr. Kenny Lofton. We're delighted to have him as a speaker.
Now, where's that event going to happen? And if people are interested, how can they be able to take advantage of it?
The Lakeshore Classic Luncheon will take place at Majestic Star Casino in their ballroom.
Mm-hmm.
Merely, all you have to do is make reservation, call the Gary Chamber office at 219 885-7407. It's as simple as that. And we are hoping the entire region comes out, because you welcome home a person who has acquitted himself and brought such acclaim to Northwest Indiana. We want Kenny to feel as though he is very beloved here in his home city and home state of Indiana.
Now, with the classic itself coming up here the following weekend, or the weekend after the big luncheon, that's November 29th and 30th, of course, right after Thanksgiving, and that's going to happen, as we mentioned earlier, at the Westside Leadership Academy. Is there anything in particular that folks that want to attend the games need to know?
Yeah, the first thing they need to know is how affordable it is.
Mm-hmm.
We want people there supporting our student athletes. That's the whole premise for the whole thing. For a two-day event, which encompasses doubleheaders each night, four games. For adults, it's a mere $10. That averages $5 a day, Chris.
Wow.
For students, it's $10 for both days. That averages $2.50 a day. That means I need to be doing what I'm doing now. I need to be knocking on doors, because we certainly provide parting gifts for the players, and we create an atmosphere which they can remember. And so I just want people to know that the Gary Chamber of Commerce is putting its skin in the game, but we're making it so affordable over the holiday season. So we just hope everybody comes out. It's a family event. Bring your children out. On Saturday, we have what we call Greeks on Parade. All of our fraternal and sorority organizations will be represented. I mean, you'll see people like Eddie Melton, who's a member of my fraternity, Kappa Alpha Psi. You'll see Earl Smith. You'll see Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, who's a member of Delta Sigma. I mean, people will be there to demonstrate to these kids when they're embarking college that there are people who preceded them, who they look up to and respect.
That's Chuck Hughes with the Gary Chamber of Commerce talking about the activities this week for the Lakeshore Classic, for tomorrow's corporate luncheon, and for the actual basketball games on Friday and Saturday. Time now for Eye on the Arts. Here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Phil Bauman, the music director of the Michigan City Messiah. And the Michigan City Messiah, well, first of all, welcome, Phil.
Hi, John. Good to be here.
It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I take it that the Michigan City Messiah is something that happens around Christmas time.
Yes, it does. It would be one of those things. It would be great to give a performance around Easter where the oratorio was wanted to be presented. But yeah, it's an annual tradition in Michigan City, and it's something that's been going on now for 55 years, and I was honored to be asked to take it over from Dan McNabb, who took it to the 50-year mark and decided to retire from that activity. And he still sings in the choir, but yeah, it's an annual tradition in Michigan City. Involves a professional orchestra, professional soloists, and a volunteer chorus. So the chorus gets together first part of November. We've had a couple of rehearsals now and get geared up to refresh the people who've been there for year after year, but also new members come every year, so we have to get them on track to do the performance.
How large is the chorus?
The chorus is vacillates from year to year, but between 80 and 100 members in the choir, so it's a substantial entity.
So it's sort of like the old Chorus Angelorum that we had here in Lake County. They were originally from Whiting, and then they started to perform elsewhere. They just performed the one big concert.
Yeah, and that's going to change this year, thanks to a grant we received from the IAC. Mm-hmm. We're going to be expanding our program and doing a program in. We haven't selected the date yet, but it'll be either May or June, and doing a completely different set of works. But getting the choir to have other experiences rather than just this. The short window between November and December. Because they're very, very excited to do other things. So we're going to open up that window for them.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, that's good. And IAC, for our listeners, is Indiana Arts Commission.
Yeah, yes. we're excited. We, after 50 years, when the changing of the guard happened, we realized that we might want to go into different directions. So we went through that process of becoming incorporated, getting our own 501c3. And then in that process, we realized there were some other avenues open to us to make granting options, so that's what we did.
Yeah, great. Well, you're beefing it up.
Yes, definitely.
So you've been involved for just 5 years then?
That's correct. This is my fifth year, and we're really excited to have some outstanding soloists with us, a couple of whom I think you might know. Kim Jones is going to be our soprano soloist, and we have Kristen Gornstein, our mezzo-soprano. She's from Michigan City but lives in New York. Kim Jones lives in Chicago. Matt Daniel is from South Bend, and he's our tenor, and Bill McMurray is our baritone. So these are amazing artists who bring a great craft to the mm-hmm. production.
And do you do the entire Messiah?
Almost. We do about 90-95%. Mm-hmm. We get it done in about 2 hours and 15 minutes with no intermission. So it's a nice trajectory from the beginning to the end. You get a real sense of the flow of the work in its entirety. Mm-hmm. And we leave very little out. But it's a really good full version.
Okay. Well, is this do you do more than one performance?
Yes, this year we're going to be doing 2 open performances plus a dress rehearsal. So we should let our listeners know that the first concert is on Saturday, December 21st at 7 p.m., and the second concert is on Sunday, December 22nd at 3 p.m., and these all take place at the First Presbyterian Church in Michigan City. There's a website, mcmessiah.com, where they can get information and tickets. The tickets are free, but there's a limited amount of availability for seating, so we ask you to get a reserve your space mm-hmm. for free, just so we make sure we don't over
capacitize. How many people approximately does the church hold?
We'll hold about 450, 500 in there.
Wow.
So it's just a magnificent production. So I really encourage people to come to it. Even if you've been to it before, it's a nice way to hit the holiday traditions.
I love the idea of these holiday performances being right before Christmas.
Yes.
So I mean, it really does make it because with the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra, we make it a little bit earlier in the month.
Sure.
So I'm so pleased that there are things that go right up to the holiday itself.
Right. This is the weekend right before Christmas. So it really does kind of cap off the celebration of the season for sure.
So you've become a nonprofit. The chorus is volunteer, I would assume.
Yes, they are. They are all volunteer, and we have professional soloists and a professional orchestra of about 24 musicians. So it's a wonderful size for a Baroque period work, and we've kind of brought it back down to that realm. I got a little romantic around the edges.
It's for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.